Morning, folks. My shoes are still squelching from, and the bottom part of my pants are really wet, so you can't tell, can you? But I just like full disclosure. I'm really uncomfortable up here right now, just, and I'm looking at a really boring feast from Leviticus. Thanks a lot, Dr. C. Let's see if we can make this a little bit interesting, perhaps. So I thought I would start by telling you a story about a student of mine. This guy joined one of my classes years ago now. His name was Elio, and he had a very long Italian surname. And I grew up in Brookvale in the 60s, so I can spot an Italian name a mile away because it was Little Italy back in those days. So I just, you know, between classes or some point, I said, oh, so Elio, that's an Italian name, you're Italian? And he was like, oh, he said, I always hate this question, he said, because, yes, that is an Italian name, because my father was Italian, so I got this name, he said, but my father, like, walked out of my mother and I when I was two, and so I don't even know him. I don't know where he is. I don't know anything about him. And I was raised by this Aussie-as mother and this kind of extended family of bogan Aussies. So, like, I'm kind of white bread Aussie. I don't know anything about being Italian, but I walk around with this, like, really obviously Italian name, and everyone asks me, what part of Italy are you from? So he says, like, so yes, but not really Italian at all. And I was like, okay, that's cool. I think it was a few years later, maybe. I sat next to him in the cafeteria at Morling and asked him how he was. And he said, I've had just the most extraordinary experience. He said, my wife and I went on holiday to Europe. We were just doing one of those kind of train trips around Europe's greatest hits. So, you know, London, Paris, Rome, Berlin, Amsterdam, all that kind of jazz. And I said to my wife before we left, well, actually, you know, we're going by train from Rome to wherever, and it'll be not far from the village where my father was born and raised. And he's not there, and, you know, I don't know anyone from there, but, you know, it'd be good to kind of visit it or sort of feel somehow connected to my Italian family roots. And she was like, of course, let's do it. So it was a side trip, apparently not an easy village to get to, and tourists don't go there, and there's nothing interesting there, and it's not a beautiful, quaint village or anything. It was purely a kind of a family heritage pilgrimage on their part. He'd found through his mother, like, some distant relative that put him in touch with somebody in this village. So he'd emailed them. They answered back in broken English. And anyway, they booked a place on Airbnb and off they went. And he said, on the way there, he said, I was having all this lack of confidence. I was like, oh, why are we even doing this? There's going to be nothing to see and no one that I know there. And I'm dragging my wife away from Florence or Venice or whatever was next on the itinerary. And he said, I was getting kind of really like, I'm an idiot, why am I even doing this? He said, and as we pulled into the station, he said, my wife had the window seat and she tugged my shirt sleeve and she said, oh my gosh, look. And he said, as we pulled into the station, there was this huge banner in English festooned across the railway station that said, welcome home, Elio. And he said, as we got off the train, we were the only people getting off. No one goes to this place. But the railway platform was full of people. And as we alighted from the train, like, people were clapping and cheering and someone was singing. And, like, no one spoke English except this one poor woman who came forward and became kind of the translator for our visit there. And so she's saying, well, this guy's your third cousin twice removed, and this woman used to be married to your uncle's stepbrother. You know, like, all these random relatives are coming up, introducing themselves. Old ladies are squeezing Elio's cheeks. He said at one point some old nonna held his face between both hands, and she said, you look just like your uncle so-and-so. He said it was just overwhelming. And he said to them, oh, could you show us to our P pensiona that we booked on Airbnb. And they said, oh, yeah, the woman who owns that told us that you'd booked in there. But don't worry, we cancelled that. You're going to be staying with your great... He's got the nicest house on the hill. And in the end, they stayed like... Instead of the one night, they stayed two nights. And like breakfast, lunch, dinner, second dinner, late night drinks, like, was with a different relative. And the poor lady that could speak English had to be at every single one of them. He said, it's not just a kind of a charming kind of connection to my extended family. He said, I feel like it's really changed me, he said. Like, since we came back, my wife and I have taken Italian classes, and I've started hanging out at this community centre with all these old Italian guys. He said, I feel like I'm learning how to become Elio. I think stories like that, like, really touch us. They do me, at least. Because I think deep down we all really, really hope that there's a place that if we went away for a long time, or even if we'd never been before, they would put up a welcome sign for us when we came back. That there's a place we belong at. There are people to whom we belong. There's a language that we should be speaking. There's a history that we should know. Like, deep down inside, we feel like we want to be at home with people who would never, ever abandon us, come what may. Last week, Dr. C, that's what I'm calling her from now on. Last week, Dr. C talked about how after the Enlightenment into humanism, there was the desacralizing of time. Do you remember when she said this? Like, time used to be a sacred thing, and it was oriented in for Israel around the feasts, and even in medieval times, like through the church and through various Christian feasts and festivals and the ringing of church bells and all that kind of stuff. And then after that, like, we desacralized time, and we're always busy, always going, always driven, always kind of, as it were, worshipping time, being pushed forward, 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 not even knowing what we're pushing ourselves toward. Like, there's an obsession with being busy all the time. And I agree. And I would say, also added to that, there is a rootlessness that comes as a result of humanism and secular culture. We're always moving. We're always going somewhere. We're always off somewhere else. Or even when we are somewhere, we're always thinking there's going to be somewhere else that we're going to go to. And our whole economic system kind of reinforces it. The whole sort of Australian dream of home ownership is all about that. We call it home ownership, but it's actually the reverse of finding a home, is it not? It's like we're going to rent this shitty place here until we can, you know, get a deposit and buy that crummy apartment there. But then once we get some collateral in that, well, then we're going to sell that and buy a less crummy place here. And then we're going to move to like Box Hill or Kellyville and put a McMansion on that place. Like, we're constantly being pushed to own and to grow. And that means to move and to move and to move, all the time pursuing what apparently is home, and at the same time being uprooted and becoming increasingly homeless. Does this make sense? In fact, way back in the 1960s, Peter Berger said this about it. This is the 1960s. He said, "We suffer from a deepening condition of homelessness, the result of the migratory character our experience of society and of self has been called a metaphysical loss of home." There's a sense in which rootlessness is as worshipped in our culture as busyness is. To stop and to be at home and to belong to a group of people, that's an unusual thing. And actually really contrary to the very values of kind of the humanist project. One of the great kind of artistic voices in the emergence of humanism was the transcendentalist Ralph Waldo Emerson, and he was famous for his kind of catch cry, which is this, oops, "Man is a free agent. You don't belong to anyone, you don't belong anywhere, you can go, travel, choose, move, start all over again." It gave particular shape to the kind of American ideal. I always find it astonishing when I go to America and you get picked up at the airport or you meet somebody and you say, "Oh, right, so we're in Dayton, Ohio. Like, tell me, what's this place like?" And they say, "Oh, I'm not so sure. I've only been here a couple of years, to be honest. Oh, where are you from? And they look at you like, what does that question actually mean? Like, where did I grow up? Because that was California. But where did I go to school? That's in Washington State. But where did I spend most of my time? That would be in Missouri. But where was I before this? That would be Florida. Like, it's just like constant moving. I'm a free agent. I can go where I want, do what I want, become what I want. Well, the Feast of Israel are actually seeking to nail people's feet down, to hold them in place. In fact, one of the ways to think about the festivals or the feasts that we've been looking at, Christine's looked at three of the spring feasts up until this point. This is the final spring feast. And if you just, between you and me, it's the best of the feasts, to be quite honest. Passover, you eat unleavened bread. It's like Rivitas and, you know, boiled eggs and bitter herbs and come on, like it's got a dramatic story for sure, like out of Egypt and all the plagues, and that's pretty cool too. But this is the festival of gluten that we're about to celebrate. So there's some serious food going to go down during the particular festival we're looking at. We're actually going to be exploring the wheat festival, the big harvest festival. And pretty much every culture has a harvest festival, but the Jewish one has a particular flavor and a particular character. As was mentioned before, it's called the Feast of Weeks, which is a kind of a lamish kind of name, but I'll use the Hebrew name because it's kind of, it's poetic. It's Shavuot, and Shavuot's just the Hebrew word for weeks. Shavuot comes right at the beginning before the great harvest of the wheat fields. Passover was a barley festival. This is a wheat festival. This is bread. This is the beginning of us storing all the grain that we're going to need to get us through the scorching hot summer in which nothing grows. And then, of course, through autumn and winter and back to spring again. Like, everything hangs on this working. Now, I remember being in the Riverina, which is a wheat-growing belt. I was a school teacher down there, and I can remember a farmer telling me how you know when to harvest wheat. I'm sure they do it all now on computers with pH balances and rain and weather and all that kind of business, but the old-fashioned way was you would go and you would snap off a seed head from one of the plants, roll it in your hands, pick the grain out as they come loose from the husks. He handed a couple to me, he said, put it in your mouth and bite it. And what do you want to happen? You want it to crunch and pop in your mouth. Because you can't grind green grain, can you? You can't grind even semi-soft grain. When it crunches when you bite into it, it's like, that's the time to start harvesting it so we can sell it and turn it into flour. But the Jews didn't need to do that. Israel actually do it mathematically, as was read to us before. How do we know when it's time to harvest the grain? You have to count off the weeks. This is how the passage that was read to us before begins. You count, after the Passover festival, you count off 7 full weeks. That's 7 Sabbaths. You count them down. Sabbath number 1, Sabbath number 2, Sabbath number 3. You're building up to Sabbath number 7. Passover is at the beginning of spring. This will come at the end of spring. So after your 7 weeks, your 49 days have finished. That's the final Sabbath. The next day will be the 50th day. And that's when Shavuot is to be celebrated. So that even though Shavuot is the Hebrew word for this, does anyone know what the Greek word for weeks, for 50th is, which by which we get the kind of Greek version of this festival? Pentecost. So Pentecost, Shavuot, same thing. It happens on the 50th day after Passover. At that particular point, you have to do something really very, very beautiful. Well, there's 2 particular aspects of the Shavuot festival that are distinct and peculiar to that festival. There's the sacrifice of animals and sin offerings and stuff like that. That was read to you before. But I want to focus on 2 of the peculiar aspects that are unique to Shavuot. The first one is this. Wherever you are, what you need to do is to go out into your field. It should be ripe for harvest with all those seed heads all waving in the breeze. You can't wait to harvest it. store all that grain and be sorted for the rest of the year. But before you do, just go off and cut enough sheaves to grind out enough flour to make 2 loaves of bread. And did you notice you can include yeast in this bread, so you get big, fluffy, crunchy, warm loaves of bread. These are called the first fruits. We don't think of bread as being fruits, but effectively they are, aren't they? That field out there is full in potential of hundreds and hundreds of loaves of bread. But before you get your hands on them, just take enough wheat to make 2 loaves and take those down to the priest as an offering. You know, lots of spring harvests, you make offerings to the gods to appease them so that they don't fry your harvest or send a drought or locusts or something like that. It's like, please, 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 please look after us. But that's not what this is about. What this is about is 2 loaves of bread down to the temple, and you say, look, Yahweh, look what we made. There's actually a riddle in the Talmud that goes like this. If man was meant to live by bread, why didn't God just create a bread tree? He could make any kind of tree. Why not a tree that just grows loaves of bread? And the answer in the Talmud is this. Because Yahweh delights in giving us a seed and sunshine and rain and invites us to plant it and tend it and harvest it and grind it and knead it and bake it and to partner him in the creation of bread. There's this beautiful sense in which, look what we did, God. Did you ever, I don't know if this still happens, but when my kids were little, they used to do school projects on big sheets of cardboard. Does anyone remember this archaic way of learning? You had to buy the cardboard. Who bought the cardboard? Me. Like, you have to kind of print off stuff at work and cut it out. Who did that? Me. You're like, you have to like design it and help them. Who does this? Like me, right? You've got to stencil the heading and the rivers of the eastern seaboard, you know, and you've got to have the map and like labels and diagrams, and they pretty it all up. I have daughters, so it's got to be kind of pink and stuff like that. And then the final indignation is when they then write, by Courtney Frost. It's like, okay, I don't want credit, but like, is there like an end note or something? Like, you know, with some assistance by, or... And I sometimes wonder whether this is a little bit like, God, look what we made. And it's like, you think you made that? No, it's okay, says God. Sure, put your name on it. Like, we did it together. There's this beautiful sense in which you gave us this bounty and we honor you. And there's a second peculiar thing that happens throughout Shavuot that I mentioned, and that is this. It was the very last verse of the reading that was read to us. When you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Leave them for the poor and for the foreigner residing among you. I am Yahweh, your God. When he says that, he means business, right? Now, I just said to you, you're a farmer. You've got a field out there with hundreds of loaves of bread in potential sitting there. Like, what does any farmer want to do but get every single grain they possibly can out of that, right? And to store it and to get all the way through the year till the next spring harvest. But what is being talked about here is, I want you to leave a border around your property. That's going to be for the poor and for foreigners who don't own land. And you know what? When you're gathering it all up and tying it into sheaves and taking it away for storage, you know, you're going to drop seed heads and that's normal. Don't hoover it all up. Leave whatever you drop for the poor and for the foreigner. Now, this is just crazy, is it not? No farmer would want to waste their product, but this is what you will do. In this respect, like all the other festivals, Shavuot becomes a homecoming feast and a homecoming festival. It's a celebration that we, as the people of God, have found our home in this place. This loaf of bread is all about saying, welcome home, Elio. Welcome home to all those of you who have found your place here in Israel. It's a welcome home to the idea that Yahweh is our great parent. Do you know every other country, every other culture around them, the gods weren't their parents, they weren't their fathers. The gods were terrifying. The gods demanded sacrifices. The gods were capricious and cruel and unpredictable. But here, in this little land here, in the middle of all of this kind of pagan worship, this little community of people are going to say, come home, come here. God is our parent. God is our father. God is our friend. Welcome home to a place where your God doesn't demand sacrifices of human flesh, where there aren't fertility rites, where women will be used and abused in order to appease the gods. Come home. God is your great parent. But more than that, it was also a celebration. Come to this place where the land gives forth its bounty. That's the most obvious thing about a spring harvest, isn't it? Like, you have given us this land. You brought us out of darkness, out of Egypt. You brought us to this place where this land will feed us, where we work with you in harmony. But more than that, there's also a sense in which we serve each other as a covenant community. Everything Dr. C's been talking about up to now in Leviticus, all the laws about how we should treat one another, about sexual ethics, about the use of land, about the care for the poor, all of that sort of stuff is all about here you'll be safe. Here, the poor, the outcast, those who come upon misfortune, those who lose their land, there's always going to be the opportunity, the hope, the debts will be cancelled, the land will be returned to its original families. It's a radical new way of being human. Every other culture around the world, what is it? It's dog eat dog. It's the survival of the fittest. It's the strong and the powerful win, and the poor and the weak. And let's be honest, women, children are crushed in the gears of a capricious and difficult land. But not here, not in this place. We take care of each other. You are knitted into this complex system of care and social security, even before there was any notion of a welfare state. And then given that last little rule that I mentioned about Shavuot and leaving some of the wheat for the poor, it is also a place where you could say, welcome home to a place where the poor and the foreigner, the one who doesn't even share our bloodline, is included in this. This feast is just the most gorgeous celebration of everything that Israel is meant to be and is called to be. Do you all follow? And as they celebrate this over generations, over hundreds and hundreds of years, actually, traditionally, they expand their vision of what Shavuot is about. Whereas Passover is all about looking back, isn't it? Passover is like, hey, way back there, remember when God did this and led us out of Egypt? What is Shavuot all about? Shavuot becomes all about one day God will send a great king and this land will be refreshed and replenished. And everything that we're intended to be will be the thing that we step into. That over time, they start to dream of a time like this, where God sends a promised king, and where famine would never strike ever again, where peace reigns, where joy and healing fill the land, and everything is set right according to God's purpose. And particularly after King David, they dream of a king just like him, only better. One who will defeat all enemies, keep away all those who might seek to oppress us, replenish the land, bring about this utopian vision of what it means to be living under the reign of God. They would talk about that at Shavuot. They would retell the story of King David. They would reread the Ten Commandments. It was all this kind of dream. It's not great now. David was pretty good. But hold on, a king is coming and a new world will be possible. That was Shavuot, forward-looking, dreaming of the future. And one of the intriguing things that they start to do, it's not mentioned in Leviticus, but it becomes part of the tradition of Israel, is that after the feast, after you've eaten all that delicious hot bread and eaten all the meat and drunk and celebrated, you're about to go out and harvest all the fields. One of the beautiful traditions is that families and clans would gather, and they wouldn't so much tell the story of Moses leading people out of Egypt. The story that they would all tell, their grandmothers, their grandfathers, their fathers, their mothers would sit them down and say, let's tell the Shavuot story. And the Shavuot story is the story of the book of Ruth. Which is kind of ingenious when you think about it. Like, of course, it's a harvest story. But it's also seditious. It's also incredibly courageous. You all know the story of Ruth, right? You can nod, but you know I'm going to tell you the story of Ruth, right? The story of Ruth is super, super clever, super clever. The story writer is a genius. Actually, it's one of the most beautifully written books in the Bible. It begins this way. I'm not going to read the whole story. But this is verse 1, chapter 1. This is the beginning of the story of Ruth, a harvest story. It goes, "In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab." Wow, like that's a mouthful. Thing you need to know to understand the book of Ruth is all the names mean something. Do you remember Pilgrim's Progress, how all the characters' names like tell you not just who they are, but what they are? Same in Ruth. All the names mean something. First name you need to know, Bethlehem. Anyone know what it means? It means house of bread. So the story begins, in the house of bread, there was no bread. The harvest had failed. People were starving. And this guy decides, now that the going has got tough, let's go where they do have bread. We're told in the next verse that his name is Elimelech, and he and his wife, Naomi, abandon Israel in their hour of need and go to a land where they believe there might be bread. Now, Elimelech is a really weird name. It's not actually a conventional name. Eli means God. Melech? Well, when you discover that they've gone to Moab, you realize that the horrible and vile and violent god of Moab was a god called Molech. Molech demanded child sacrifices. Molech was cruel and capricious. So we think that the name means Eli Melech. Molech is my god. He's gone to take his chances with the god of Moab. And sure enough, when you live under a god who demands human sacrifice, what does Elimelech end up having to pay for a few meals of bread? The ultimate price. His sons marry Moabite women, but each of his sons dies. And then he dies. He pays the price for abandoning Israel and serving a god of death. And so the story takes a turn when Naomi decides, there's nothing for me here. There's nothing for me under the god Molech. I'll return to the home, to Bethlehem. I'll return to the house of bread. I think maybe in some respects she's going to die in the land of her forefathers. And so her two daughter-in-laws start packing. They're dutiful daughters, that you do what your mother says. And so Naomi turns to them and says, oh, no, no, you're still young. You can marry Moabite men and have a life here in Moab. No, 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 don't come with me. And Orpah, one of the sisters, daughters-in-law, I don't know how much enthusiastic packing she'd done, because she's kind of like, whew, I was hoping you were going to say that. So she's like unpacking as quickly as she can, and she's staying here in Moab. But Ruth, whose name means loyalty or friendship, Ruth does the most unlikely thing. There's nothing for her in Israel. There's no hope for her in that place. But she says, you know the speech, don't you? Your God will be my God, your people will be my people, your land will be my land. And so she travels back to Bethlehem. And chapter 1 ends like this. It's like this big pregnant pause, isn't it? Chapter 1 ends, so Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, arriving in the house of bread as the barley harvest was beginning. It's a cliffhanger, isn't it? Like, this is like, oh, right, okay. Like, the harvest is beginning, bread is back, Israel has been blessed. Poor woman and a foreign woman have landed in the house of bread. What will happen? Turn the page. Ruth goes out to a relative of Naomi's called Boaz, to his farm, and does what she's allowed to do at Shavuot, which is she gleans all the leftovers. This is like having a relative who owns the IGA at Balgowla Heights, and he says, you can dumpster dive and grab any stuff out of the bins at the back you like. It's like, just pick up whatever you can. Good on him, because that's what was required. He does the bare minimum, definitely. He even says to his workers, let her drink the water from the well that you drink at. He even actually gives her some lunch. And he says to her, I want to pronounce a blessing over you. I will allow you to work my fields, not work them, but glean them. And I tell my men to leave you alone. It always makes me wonder, what would they have done if he hadn't told them to leave her alone? And then he pronounces this blessing. It sounds beautiful. He says, I've been told all about what you've done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband. How you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you've done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. If it was a Christian story, he would probably have genuflected at that point. Go in peace, my sister. Blessings on you. Head out to the dumpster. You can take all the food that you like. And that's it. A blessing, a promise of refuge, the opportunity to pick up the dross, but no more. Does this not ring very true for you? Is this like, wait a second, what about all those rules in Leviticus about how to treat the poor and the foreigner? Wait a second, don't you have all these rules about how men should provide sons for widows and families should knit in relatives and redeem those who've been... What about all that stuff that you talk about? All the stuff Dr. C's been teaching us about all this time. What about all that kind of stuff? Hold on, wait a second. There's a whole system where people like these two should be knitted in. Like, not just like a blessing, go in peace, pick up what you possibly... There's going to be more to it than that, surely, surely. And chapter 3, verse 1 is like really heartbreaking. This is when Naomi says to her, my daughter, I must find home for you. You got charity, you got a blessing, but we didn't find home. And what is Shavuot all about? It's a festival of homecoming. We promised home. We put up a banner, welcome home, Naomi. We said all the right things. We did the bare minimum, but you're not home. This story gets kind of squeamish after this, doesn't it? These two women conspire. They say, what can we do? What source of power do we possibly have? There's no law courts. There's no judge we can go to. There's no great relative we can go to support us. Like, what do we do now? What can we do? We're empty-handed, exhausted, poor, hungry women, and you a foreigner. And so Naomi cooks up the most devious plan. She says, the only power we have at our disposal, Ruth, is your beauty and your youth. You know the story, you know how it goes. Pietistic Christians find it very disturbing. She lies next to him, uncovers his feet, which is a euphemism. He's drunk and exhausted from having brought in the barley harvest. He wakes up. In the Hebrew it says, he looked at her and went, what? What? What did I do last night? In effect, she's saying to him, you promised us a home where Yahweh is our parent. You promised us a home where we benefited from the bounty of the land that God gave us. You promised us a home where we could be knitted into this covenant community. You promised us, the poor and the foreigner, a place in this land. She takes Israel by the scruff of the neck and says, you come good on what you promised. And Boaz is shamed into doing probably what he should have done from the very beginning. There's a loophole with an extended relative he tries to begin with, but in the end it's like, no, it's on me. And he takes them into his home. He provides sons for Ruth. And the kicker in this story that you're telling at Shavuot is, and those two sons become descendants of who? The king, David, whose son we're waiting for. Don't you think? Well, actually, it was at Shavuot, 50 days after Passover, that Jewish men and women, followers of that king, King Jesus, were gathered, when all of a sudden the first fruits fall on them. It's not us saying, "Here, Yahweh, look what we made, first fruits of the harvest." It's the first fruits of things to come descend on them. The Holy Spirit fills them with this extraordinary power, and tongues of fire land, as it were, upon their heads, and an extraordinary new birth of humanity occurs. This is Shavuot, folks. They've been offering their bread offerings and saying their prayers and following Jesus and learning from all his disciples. And this happens. And the thing that I really dig about this is as they start speaking in tongues, I know some Pentecostals, charismatics, like to speak in tongues as a devotional language and all, which is lovely. This is a devotional language. What do they start doing? They start speaking in different languages. So much so that, I know this is a long verse, but it's just so good you've got to like read the whole thing out. Now they were staying in Jerusalem, God-fearing Jews from every nation under heaven. They'd all come to Passover, and they were staying the 50 days to Shavuot before they could go home. When they heard this sound, a crowd came together in bewilderment because each one heard their own language being spoken. Utterly amazed, they asked, "Aren't all of these who are speaking Galileans? Then how is it that each of us hears our own native language? Parthians and Medes, Elamites, residents of Mesopotamia, Judea and Cappadocia, Pontus and Asia, Phrygia and Pamphylia, Egypt and the parts of Libya near Cyrene, visitors from Rome, both Jews and converts to Judaism, Cretans and Arabs, we hear them declaring the wonders of God in our own tongues. Amazed and perplexed, they ask each other, 'What does this mean?'" Now, I don't know about you, but I always think, was there a disciple running around saying, "Where are you from? Phrygia, right? Did you hear it in your own language? Good. Well, where are you from? Asia? Good. Cappadocia? Have we got any Mesopotamians here?" Like, somebody recorded them all, right? Because here's the amazing thing. They're all Ruths. It's like we've been telling the story of the foreign woman who is blessed by God and bought into the inheritance that God intended for the world. And now all these Ruths from all over the world have come here and they can hear the gospel being proclaimed in their language. It's the first fruits. It's everything we yearn for. This is Shavuot as it was meant to be. Like, it's extraordinary. And then Peter gets up and says, "Let me explain what's going on." And it's a really long sermon, so I'm only going to focus on kind of the high point of it because we're running out of time. But Peter says, "Let me explain it to you, just in case you wondered. Do you know why you can all hear us speaking? Because you're all Ruths, you're all foreigners, and you are hearing this in your own language because of this. Fellow Israelites, I can tell you confidently that the patriarch David died and was buried, and his tomb is here today. But he was a prophet and knew that God had promised him an oath that he would place one of his descendants on the throne. Seeing what was to come, he spoke of the resurrection of the Messiah, that he was not abandoned to the realm of the dead, nor did his body see decay. God has raised this Jesus to life, and we're all witnesses of it. Exalted to the right hand of God, he has received from the Father the promised Holy Spirit and has poured out what you now hear and see." Why does he have to mention David? Because he's saying at Shavuot, you are yearning for the son of Ruth, the son of David. You wanted another David. But we buried David. I can tell you, I can show you where he's buried. But this new king has come who will not be buried, who was raised to life and has been ascended to the Father. The true son of David, the true son of Ruth has arrived. Everything we prayed for and hoped for every Shavuot has happened now, here at Pentecost. Let's go now and live as God intended us to live. Let us live with God as our parent. Let's live on the bounty of the land he's given. Let us live as a covenant people. Let us include the poor and the foreigner. One of my favorite writers is Wendell Berry. And he was asked once, "What's our true work in this world?" And he said this. He said this: make a home. Help make a community. Be loyal to what you've made. Put the interests of your community first. Love your neighbors. Not the neighbors you pick out, but the ones you have. That's the spirit of Pentecost. The spirit of Pentecost is we're home. And we're inviting other people to come and find home with Jesus as their friend, their king, and their savior. Do you follow? I'll close with this quote from Alan Roxburgh. Wendell Berry is just a lovely, beautiful farmer, poet from Kentucky. Alan Roxburgh is an abrasive, cranky bloke from Liverpool who just as likely punch you as teach you, but listen to this, it's brutal. We need a movement of God's people into neighbourhoods to live out and be the new future of Christ. This is not the same as current attempts to grow bigger and bigger churches that act like vacuum cleaners, sucking people out of their neighbourhoods into a sort of Christian supermarket. Our culture does not need any more churches run like corporations. It needs local communities empowered by the gospel vision of a transforming Christ who addresses the needs of the context and changes the polis or the city into a place of hope and wholeness. The corporation churches we are cloning across the land cannot birth this transformational vision because they have no investment in context or place. They are centres of expressive individualism with a truncated gospel of personal salvation and little else. Our penchant for bigness and numerical success as the sign of God's blessing only discourages and deflects attempts to root communities of God's people deep into neighbourhoods. This is your work, folks. To bake bread, to put up welcome home signs, to include the outsider, to welcome the outcast, to be the home that we're all yearning for. Let me say a prayer. Father, help us because we don't know how to be good neighbours. I don't know how many people from McMillan Street will come to this party, Lord. Usually it's not many of them. Many of us don't know our own neighbours or many people in our own streets. So lovely to hear this woman, Lord, talk about borrowing a can opener, to hear Nat talking about sticky beaking at the house down the street. Let these not just be rare or random occurrences. Let us be the kind of people who make homes. And I don't just mean beautiful houses, Lord. I mean make homes in places where people are so desperate to be welcomed home. And in doing that, might we point out to them, we only have the courage and the strength and the vision for this because you gave it to us in your Son and our Saviour, our King, our friend, our rock, our Redeemer, Jesus. We pray in his name. Amen.